Welcome to the Life in the Stocks podcast, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Matt Stocks. I'm the host, and the show features unedited, in-depth, candid conversations with a wide range of musicians, actors, comedians, and creatives. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to Life in the Stocks on your favorite podcast platform. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and indeed all major podcast platforms. Be sure to give me a follow on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok as well, at Matt Stocks DJ. That way you can keep up to date with all of my live Q&A dates, my DJ performances, and of course, who's coming up on the show as well. But without further ado, let's crack on with the show, shall we? Here we go.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Okay, well, it was nice to see your face for all of 2 seconds.
Yeah.
And we'll switch to the audio format from here on in. Maybe we'll jump back onto the camera at the end to wrap things up. So, dude, nice to meet you first and foremost. Thank you for taking the time to come on the show. And, yeah, really excited to get into a myriad of different topics and talking points with you. I guess we should begin, if it's all right with you, going back 20 years now, which must seem wild. So I did like an article about a year and a half, 2 years ago for Metal Hammer. And it was like the 20 best punk documentaries. And I was kind of going through all the different ones. You know, obviously the research was to watch them all, which was a lot of fun. I included your film on the list. So I'd seen it already and rewatching it again ahead of today's chat. I guess so many things are different now as opposed to when you made the film. What I'd love to sort of start out by talking about is the most notable differences, developments, things that you've seen from the moment you made the film to where we're at now, culturally, but I guess also technologically as well, because when you made that film, Afropunk, social media was not a thing. Obviously, the internet was in its very early stages, and so to track down all of these people must have been its own adventure in and of itself, and there wasn't that infrastructure back then and communities that now exist online and ways in which you can quote unquote find your tribe quite as easily. So yeah, I guess first of all the kind of research development and then going into the filming of the project itself, how did you go about finding all of these people and documenting their stories?
Yeah, no, those are all good questions. So the film came out in 2003, but I started making it in 2001. So this was the time I didn't have a computer. I didn't even have an email address when I started the project. So it's hard to even imagine that something that people could exist like that, you know? But I had no need for any of that kind of stuff. So part of making this film was just like buying a computer. you know.
I love it. That's how old school we're talking, which must blow young people's minds now. Like, what, you didn't have one already in your pocket?
So, you know, I remember, you know, and this is kind of like granular, but, you know, I remember talking to somebody who knew about tech and stuff. And I was like, yeah, I have this idea for making a movie. Like, I need something where I can like search the internet and like edit a movie. And he was like, okay, those are like two drastically different things, you know? And really, you have to buy, you know, the whatever the latest Apple was, you know, I think it was a G4, right?
Yeah, I remember that.
Tower, right?
Classic
so,
model.
Yeah. So I bought, you know, I maxed out my credit card, bought this like $2,000, you know, tower. I still had to buy a monitor, you know, all of the stuff, you know, I had to get like the internet, which I was living in Williamsburg, Brooklyn at the time, and like DSL didn't exist yet. You know, for those who are not old enough, like, to know, like, we had dial up, which you probably heard of, but then the faster internet was DSL, you know, and I didn't, the whole city didn't have it yet, you know. So going to your question, like, how did I find people, you know, like, I remember when Google came out, you know, so I was like on Ask Jeeves before that, you know, like, somebody in Texas was like, oh, Black Stacy, you know, and I was like, is there a White Stacy? No, we, you know, it's like, so, you know, so it was really just like people calling out the Black people in their scene, and then me like sending them an email telling them what I'm trying to do. You know, that combined with like who are bands that have Black membership, and then trying to track those people down, you know. I'm 47.
So you're 10 years older than me. So, and I was reading, you kind of grew up between both LA and New York. So you kind of, I guess, had a bit of a grasp on both the East and the West Coast scene. So you,
to a degree, I got into punk in a small town in Southern California, which is like what my graphic novel, The High Desert, is about.
But
that was really like, we didn't have, it was such a small town. We didn't have a scene. We didn't have shows. Like, there wasn't like access, you know. A couple years later, I moved to New York, and then I, you know, so I, like, that's where I was like rooted. And, you know, so right when I started the project, I was like, oh, okay, I got to talk to like, you know, Ryan from Bushmon and Luke Mon from Funk Face and Chaka from Burn and, you know, like, just the random, oh yeah, there's like, there's a Black dude in Cro-Mags now. Like, I gotta like, who's that guy? I need to find him, you know? Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Like Todd, the other Todd from Warzone, like, he's Black, you know, I remember him from Washington Square Park, you know, like that kind of thing, like really just kind of going through my memories and being like, oh, wasn't there like a Black guy in Worlds Collide? And, you know, like that kind of thing. And then trying to find these people, again, was like, do they have an email address? You know, like, you know, it was definitely its own, you know, chore.
Yeah, I'll bet. And so from a scene point of view at that time, like, especially in New York, you know, what's your memories of that particular geographical punk scene at the time you were around, in terms of the bands who were around, the bands who were big, and also, I guess, just the overriding vibe? Because New York obviously went through so many different, what's crazy to me is, pre, again, internet, social media times, scenes would flip so quick, and you know, in the space of 2 years, you'd have such radically different audience members and bands, and everything would move so fast. What kind of time period are we talking where you're entrenched in that New York scene, and who are the bands that are kind of leading it at that point? And yeah, like I said, what's the overall vibe? Is it like a violent time? Is it a positive time? Is the veganism and those kind of politics there when you're around? Did you miss that, or did it come later? What was going on?
Sure. Well, I moved to New York in 1991, and so I missed the kind of like CB's matinee era. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I saw the first Gorilla Biscuit show.
Right.
Does that make sense? Like,
yeah.
when they first were like, we're not playing anymore. So I was at that show. You know, like I saw Burn, you know, like kind of like the second generation of those Revelation Records bands, like some of that stuff. But you have to remember that New York is so huge that I counted a few months back, like there were something like 28 places to play under, like below 14th Street in Manhattan, you know? Wow. So, with all of those options came like wildly different scenes, you know? Right. So if you were like a street punk and you were into like the Casualties or something, right, who was just getting started around then, like you didn't have to go see Sick of It All, or, you know, you didn't have to go to, you know, see the, I don't know, like the Selector when they came to town or whatever, you know, like you didn't have to participate in things like when you're like from a smaller place, you kind of like, you get these shows where it's like a ska band and then like a hardcore band and then like a metalcore band. Like it's like all kinds of stuff. Right.
Yeah.
So, and I was somebody who, like, when I moved to New York, I was like a Mohawk punk. I was looking for that kind of stuff, and I came across a fairly unknown all-black punk band called Bushmon that really just like blew my mind. Like, just really opened the idea that, like, you know, this is they were an example to me of like how you could be a black punk. You know, like in the flesh. It wasn't like, you know, Bad Brains or Fishbone, these bands that you can't, you know, actually touch, right? And, you know, and within them, there were these, or within their scene, there was like a lot of different kinds of like ska bands, and, you know, there's just like a lot of bands that are kind of unknown. I could rattle off names, and most people, unless you were there, wouldn't know these bands. They didn't really record that much, or, you know, but then I started kind of getting into hardcore more, and that was more of a New York tough guy, like wannabe DMS kind of, that was like a kind of local gang or whatever, like just a lot of meatheads, you know?
Yeah.
And not very like political. It was more just like tough posturing and stuff. And that didn't really appeal to me very much. Eventually I started getting into politics, and the music that I was liking, like they would maybe play at ABC No Rio, which is like a squat in East Lower East Side. But they didn't come to New York that much. And something that a lot of people don't talk about when it comes to the New York scene is that, like, there are all these huge bands that came out of New York, but then there are all these bands that never played New York, you know? Like, if you were from New Jersey, you might never play New York, you know? It was, like, very closed off. So, and touring bands would often go from New Jersey and then go to Long Island or Connecticut. So they're not dealing with New York at all.
Yeah, it's a totally different genre and scene altogether, but there's the great Twisted Sister documentary, and it shows how they, for like 20 years or something crazy, before they even got signed, and would not, as you say, go into New York, because they'd have, were they Long Island? Where were they? They had a specific region.
They were Long Island.
Yeah.
And they were just not, they couldn't break into the scene. And that was the thing, is like New York outside of ABC No Rio or like C Squat, like most of the places, the 28 places that I mentioned, they all have bookers, you know, and those bookers have relationships, and they're like, you know, there's like capitalism. At the end of the day, you're like trying to sell beer, you know, like it's a whole different world. So there's not a lot of DIY, you know, at the time. So I started going out of the city so that I could see these more political bands. And this is kind of like my heyday, which is kind of like the, you know, maybe first, maybe second generation emo, right? So it's like this, like the screamy political bands, like Frail and Chokehold, and, you know, I don't know, Policy of Three, or, you know, that all the West Coast stuff, like Struggle and Downcast and Heroin. Like, these are all kind of like, you know, the Ebullition Records, the Gravity Records, Bloodlink Records, like all that stuff, is where I kind of really came into my own and like started doing zines, started putting on shows, started like, you know, my own record label, just like really entrenching myself in what, to me, what punk rock is really all about, which is like DIY, you know?
Let me ask you this, James. Is there a good documentary about that time period, scene, community, record labels, all those bands you just listed? I'm not aware of one, but is there? And if there isn't, it sounds to me like you're the guy who should be doing one.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the story of those bands is just starting to be told. Like, you know, that record label, Numero Group, they've been repressing all of that stuff and really kind of shining a light on bands like Indian Summer and Current, Boilermaker. Like, they're putting out like these really beautiful box sets, not Native Nod. Like, they're putting out all of these really beautiful kind of collector's editions of this kind of lost music, you know? So I know there's a documentary about the San Diego scene from that time. I can't remember what it's called right now, but
would you do another documentary, or because I've made one and I know how time consuming they can be and how emotionally draining they can be. And I know you do several other things as well. You mentioned obviously the graphic novel. You're a tattoo artist. You made a feature film. There's plenty of other things you've done. Would you ever return to the medium that you sort of, you know, I guess for lack of a better term, sort of made your name in? Is that something that appeals to you, or do you feel like you've done it and there's much more, you know, other mediums out there?
I don't have like a strong desire to do it. I think that you know, I'm really interested in telling stories about people of color. And, you know, so unless I was like, you know, there, if there was like some world where, like, I don't know, like, you know, I'm trying to think of who I would want, like, maybe I would be interested in I really want to see a documentary about, Martin from Los Crudos and Limp Wrist, you know? So like, I want that to exist. Like, that would be something that in the right world I might consider. But like, you know, right now I'm just kind of like interested in writing. So, I'm trying to tell some of that story. Like, I have a book deal now that I'm writing. And I'm trying to tell some of that story, but you know, it's through my like pointed perspective. So, you know, it's definitely not going to be like a history lesson or a who's who of like, you know, proto screamo or whatever, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's, you know, you've got your upcoming tours at the Punk Rock Museum to get into the history of all that stuff. Can you tell me anything about the book and the subject matter and where you're headed with that, or is it far too early in the game?
Oh no. So yeah, I mean, basically, I'm writing a writing about my the events that led me to make Afropunk, and then my experience with like building Afropunk as a community, and then it being like kind of like swept up and kind of, you know, I don't want to sound like a victim, but like, you know, taken from me because I got caught up in like capitalism. I got caught up in like, you know, trying to grow a community and at the same time like accidentally built a brand, you know. You know, so it's kind of like the pitfalls of like how the mainstream gobbles up the underground, you know.
Well, it's very difficult to keep your nose clean when you get any form of success in an artistic world. I think because especially, you know, DIY underground stuff in particular, the moment that becomes a commodity, it's almost in kind of, you know, direct confliction of the original ideals at the core of the thing. But then the flip side to that is that you want to get these ideas and these forms of expression and artists and voices, you want to get them seen and heard by as many people as possible. It's a really hard line to walk, isn't it? And to keep your integrity and stay true to the, you know, the original intent, whilst also, you know, financially existing.
All of those things are issues, you know. It's definitely, you know, it's to like kind of reiterate what you're saying or expand on it. It is that thing of like, I have this great message. I want as many people as possible to hear it, but I'm in the underground. And in order to reach more people, I need to like stick my head out of the underground and hope it doesn't get chopped off, you know? And it really, I don't know exactly what the answer is, but, it seems like, you know, there is some kind of line. There is some kind of division between the mainstream and the underground. And I can confidently say that, like, when a person, a band, an artist, whatever, like, crosses that line, I don't think that they're punk anymore. I'm not the decider of where that line is, you know, but I think that for those of us who have spent time existing in the underground, like it's pretty clear. Like we can point to a particular band or a particular album or whatever and be like, oh, that's when they crossed the line, you know. So, you know, I guess I try not to have any. Like I try to be honest with myself. Like I'm writing about punk. I'm writing about DIY. I'm writing about the underground, but I'm also doing it for mainstream publishers. So like, let's not pretend that this is like a punk book, you know, it's like a book about punk, you know? And I think that if we can be honest with ourselves as artists, then it becomes less convoluted. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. It's off topic ever so slightly, but it's something that's just popped into my head, and it, you know, isn't punk in the traditional sense, but I mean, I think the dude is about as punk as it gets, but I would love to get your thoughts on Eminem. The line goes dead.
No. I mean, I haven't thought about Eminem in years, but so the two things that come up right away is like, I think when I was younger, I like really had this like, you know, fuck that dude, like kind of, you know, kind of equating him to Elvis type thing. Uh-huh. But I can't deny that he is a like great lyricist. And the thing that kind of turned my head around about like how I felt about him was when I actually listened to his lyrics, I was like, oh, he's not like talking about black stuff. He's not like posturing and trying to, he's talking about like white trash stuff, you know? Like I felt that, you know, I was like, oh, there's a certain authenticity to him that I wasn't mad about, you know, coupled with his talent. It wasn't like he's just like some nepotistic star, you know? So, you know, I definitely can hear the argument about like there are people being better than him, like people who like didn't get on that should have, or all of that kind of him being the only rapper who gets to be on rock radio, like all those kind of conversations are authentic and real. And also he's like talented and he's, you know, talking about, you know, real white guy stuff. Also, I take, like, I really am trying to remove the adjective punk to stuff that's not punk, because what it does is like suggest that there was no rebellion in arts before punk, you know? And the fact of the matter is that like there is like rebellious, even DIY hip hop. There is, you know, there was rebellious DIY jazz, you know, years before punk was even an idea, before rock and roll was even an idea, you know? So, you know, and like when I learn about like the history of techno, I'm like, those guys are doing the exact same things that punk rockers were doing, like in terms of like making their own product, you know, making these like records that only press to 1,000 that only a few people care about, you know, like doing underground shows, like all of the stuff. But they're not punk, you know? And to call them punk kind of diminishes, it's like, oh well, we need to filter it through this white rock and roll lens, you know? And it really makes me feel like, you know, who's like punker than punk is like, I don't know, like Betty Davis or, you know, Sly Stone or whatever. But like, let's not call them punk. Like they are R&B artists, and R&B artists are also allowed to be wild and rebellious. You know what I'm saying?
I hear what you're saying. There's a certain level of purism there, which I can get down with. I want to ask you this, though, to maybe throw a wild card into the mix. Is Little Richard punk?
No, he's rock and roll. He's R&B. And I think, again, it's like when you start calling things punk that aren't punk, it does a disservice to both punk and to the genre that it's like that you're taking something from it. You're saying that like if Little Richard is punk, then that what that tells me is that like your vision of R&B or soul music or rock and roll music, depending on what song you're talking about or whatever, is that it has to be this one way. Maybe they only do love songs or something, you know, like they only do safe stuff, whatever. And it's like, nah, like if you look at the history of music, people were always wild, you know, like there's always that element. So like let's give praise where praise is due, you know, like the Sex Pistols didn't invent chaos in music, you know.
No, they did popularize safety pins through the facial parts though, didn't they?
we could give them that 100%.
And gobbing, I guess the reason I asked that is because for me there's nothing more punk than being like a black gay cross-dressing flamboyant over the top wild entertainer in the deep south of America in the 1950s. That and same thing with Eminem, like being, you know, as obnoxious and offensive and dangerous and out of control as his art was at that time. And so for me, I think I've always looked at punk more, and obviously everybody has their own interpretation of it, obviously, but for me, it's more about an attitude than a sound or a style or a look. It's more.
And I would agree with that. I just, you know, here's where I start to come along with that, where I start to develop my feelings about it. Because at a certain point, like, you know, 15 years on into Afropunk, the festival, the brand, yeah, they were no longer supporting punk acts. Like, they didn't have anything remotely rock and roll, or, you know, maybe one or two acts on the stage, but it was mostly R&B, you know? And but then, so when they would be questioned, they would be like, oh, well, punk is an attitude. Punk is an energy, you know? And also they go so far as to say that Black people in America, by existing, are punk, you know?
Right.
And I understand the sentiment, because, you know, in a lot of ways, Black people have had to be underground, have had to be DIY, you know, like, have had to, you know, and all of these art forms that we're talking about all come from Black experiences, you know? So I get it, but also you can't tell me that, like, you know, some Black dude at church or on the basketball team is punk. You know what I'm saying? Just because they're Black. You know, it starts to get way too, like, convoluted. Even though those people, the guy at church, may have more in common with punk in terms of, like, being ostracized, being the only person, you know, at his job that's into whatever, you know, whatever, right? Like, taking on the man in that way may have more in common with them than the kid who got a Green Day shirt at Hot Topic and, you know, like, is taken care of by his parents. You know what I'm saying? Like,
for sure, yeah.
So in order for me to just be like, have like a streamlined understanding, I'm like, yeah, let's stop calling Eminem punk, because he's a rapper, and rappers are allowed to be obnoxious. You know, rappers are, like, let's look at the history of hip hop, and you're gonna find some wild out there. I mean, look at African Bambaataa, you know what I'm saying? Like, right at the beginning, right? Like, wild out there stuff. Like, but to call him punk is to take something away from hip hop. You feel me?
Yeah, man, absolutely. So, God, there's so many things I want to ask you. So I had Chuck D on the show a couple of years back, and he's got a great...
a lot of people call him punk, right?
Yeah, man. And he actually narrated a whole series on The Clash for Spotify. So it's kind of, that's weird. It's like, it's Chuck D from Public Enemy narrating a documentary series about The Clash, which is punk as fuck, but then it's on Spotify, and you're like, ah, again, how do you exist without the commercial commodities of, you know, consuming the medium? But he talked a lot. I can't remember the name of his book. It's driving me mad. But he talked a lot in his book. It's all about the African-American experience. And he talked about how nothing is going to change until we get Black voices in businesses and corporations, and obviously in the media and in politics and the government. And only then, because it's, let's be honest, right, we're all pushing against, to different extents, these pillars of power. And unless the pillars of power change, nothing really around it changes. You just get, you know, your head turns from left to right, and distractions are here, there, and everywhere. And there's things to always be fighting about. But until the actual core of the system can be, you know, represented with more queer people and females and, you know, the whole cross section of society, then nothing's going to change. And so I feel like since your film was made 20 years ago, a lot from me sitting over here from the UK, at least, looking at America, and I'm just talking specifically about America here, because that's obviously, you know, where you live and that's your perspective. Where do you feel like the American government is at and that kind of post-Obama world. Do you feel like the situation for African-American people growing up in America are looking to get into politics specifically? Do you feel like there's more opportunity and you know, potential there after your country has now had a Black president? Or do you feel like in many ways not a lot has changed?
I know. Yeah, I mean, that was
a big question. That,
yeah, and it's also like a, you know, very 2008 question, you know, because we've also had, you know, we've also had Trump.
Of course.
And when and Biden, you know, so like, yeah, I think that there is space and interest and desire for Black representation in politics. And I think a kind of a more important question is like, you know, because Black people aren't a monolith, you know, like we can't say that like, you know, I'm trying to think of some examples. I don't know. There are like very progressive Black politicians who, you know, are typically in like kind of like the House of Representatives or something, right? And then there's like Kamala Harris, our vice president, who's just like, you know, pretty conservative, you know? And, you know, I'm not somebody that believes that like Black capitalism is the answer to white capitalism, you
right.
know?
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
I think that like once you get to a certain level of power or a certain level of wealth,
Well, then you become entrenched in the thing you are.
Everybody has the same ability to start being corrupt, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And
well, let's be real, right? The root of all evil is capitalism. And I feel like in this world, in today's age, for me personally, that's my personal viewpoint is like,
sure. Like, yeah, I mean, it's like, let's not, you know, say like, oh, well, race doesn't matter or whatever, like all that stuff matters, but it's all connected to like capitalism and, you know, and economics and wealth and like the ability to gain wealth and whatever, right? Yeah. So, you know, so I think that, you know, and I'm no expert on like, you know, governmental politics or whatever, but I think that like, yeah, we want to see ourselves represented in all aspects of life. You know, to have like a progressive Black senator or mayor or any of that, like they're going to be the people who like are more likely to look out, right? But just because they're Black doesn't mean they're going to look out, you know? It could actually mean quite the opposite. So I think it's more a question of like, who has our best interests in mind? And I think when I hear what you're recounting Chuck D's statement, I start thinking about things like media, and when they start hiring people of color in the positions to greenlight TV shows or whatever. Then we start seeing people of color telling like more nuanced stories, you know?
Yeah.
And to go back to your very, very first question about like how things have changed, you know, when I was in 2003, when Afropunk came out, there was exactly one Black person in all of Hollywood who had the power to greenlight a movie, you know? And now there are lots, you know, like it's not like we like, you know, party's over, we got it, you know, but it's like there are more opportunities. And a lot of that came out of the uprisings around George Floyd, you know. it's like, oh shoot, like we have to start hiring people of color to like balance out our workforce, you know? And, you know, unfortunately, sometimes it takes murder and an uprising for people to like open their eyes and be like, oh, this is white privilege? I didn't realize that, you know?
And male privilege as well, which obviously the Me Too movement highlighted massively. And I think as awful as the pandemic was, and I don't want to, you know, say anything too outrageous here, but so much good came from that time in relation to over here in England. We had a female who basically disappeared because she was walking home one night and a policeman, I'm sure you heard the story, Sarah Everard, her name was, a UK policeman picked her up and said, you know, I'll take you home. And he ended up murdering her. And so there was this huge, you know, like wave of protests led by women in the UK, peaceful protests. And obviously everything off the back of Rose McGowan's book and kind of Harvey Weinstein's downfall and all of that, you know, coinciding with the Black Lives Matter movement after George Floyd and all of that. I feel like, you know, the pandemic was a catalyst for a lot of that stuff.
Well, we had time, you know, we were
exact time, everybody space was pissed.
Everybody was pissed for one reason or another, you know, and these things happened in a time where everyone was stoked to get outside, you know, so it's like, yo, let's like, we were able to mobilize huge numbers, you know, because of the moment, you know, and, you know, I mean, I would love to believe that that every protest could make that kind of mark, you know, or shift the dial like that, you know. Time will tell.
Life is full of what ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome. Like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Yeah, another thing I wanted to ask you about, I can't remember who mentioned this to me. It was somebody I interviewed. It wasn't Chuck, but somebody else fairly recently spoke about how rock stars and musicians and a lot of famous and certainly pop stars, a lot of these people in the music, mainstream music community now, don't really use their platform to affect change. But actually what's happened a lot specifically in America is athletes have been leading the charge in recent times. And I think that's amazing, because when you think kind of traditionally and historically how conservative the sports world has been with a little c, and how, you know, people just kind of turn up, do the job, win the trophy, whatever. But then there's been this wave in recent times of like, no, actually athletes are like saying this is not acceptable, and taking the knee and all that kind of stuff. And I'd love to get your take on that as someone who's obviously, you know, from an artistic and musical kind of background. But I'm not a fan of any sort of sports, but I can respect the shit out of that. And I'd be interested to hear your take and in the way athletes, again, kind of especially in America, have led a lot of this kind of conscious awakening when it comes to equality.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I can really say much more than you. Like, I don't watch any sports whatsoever.
Classic punks.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, I can only venture a guess that, like, you know, we're dealing with a younger generation of mostly Black people who, you know, are just willing to speak up. You know, I mean, yeah, it's like I said, I mean, it's like I can kind of just talk to my general feeling about where Black people are in our society or whatever, but I don't know anything about sports, so I'm the wrong guy to talk about it.
I think one thing that's very alarming and, you know, awful and confusing and just a whole bunch of things, but where kind of, like, you know, a lot of these heartland American, to generalize, and apologies for the generalization, but, you know, that's often where strong feelings of racism reside, right, is in certain geographical pockets of the states. And these people will cheer on their favorite sports stars who also happen to be of a certain color on sports day. But then the rest of the week, they'll go back to, like, being prejudiced and bigoted. And I find that misalignment one of the more, you know, just for me, mad things about the human ability to compartmentalize their thoughts and issues on things.
Yeah, totally. You know, I mean, and that goes back to just, like, you know, Black people are here to entertain us.
Yes. Know? Yeah. And, which Chuck talks, you know, a lot about that in his book as well. It's like, it's okay if you're a performer or an entertainer or an athlete. And that's kind of all traditionally African Americans have been allowed to do in any sort of successful way, which is fucked. But has obviously, as you say, obviously has changed loads since your film came out. And what was sort of interesting to me is you get two bands, you mentioned them earlier, Fishbone and Bad Brains. Now, in the wake of those two bands, because every white musician I've spoken to from, you know, the 80s onwards, who was around Fishbone in LA and around Bad Brains in DC and New York and all around there, were all in awe of those guys. Was there not a massive wave of young Black kids picking up guitars after watching those bands? Or was it just that they weren't really in those scenes to begin with to see them, and those guys were just playing to predominantly white audiences?
I think it was both. I think that, you know, I wouldn't call it a massive wave, but I think that what those bands did for the Black youth, seeing them at the time, was validate their experience simply by existing, by example. You know, like, oh, here is an amazing artist doing this thing, that means I can be here too, right? I think that the difference between the 80s, 90s Black punk and the Black punk of today is that, and I'm kind of speaking generally, so, like, don't crucify me, but I'm feeling like, there is a sense of, like, meet me where I am in Black punks today. You know, like, if you see a band like Zulu or Soul Glow, like, two of the biggest bands in the scene today, like, they're so unapologetically Black, and seeing them live is like, every white person in that room has to come to them. You know, like, we're no longer going to worry about making you uncomfortable, you know? And so when I grew up, the energy that I got from a lot of Black punks was like, let's not put the spotlight on me as a Black person. And there are clear exceptions, but, you know, like, that's the energy. And, you know, if we're going to talk about race, it's going to be in terms of like unity that feels really like also feels safe and inclusive, right?
Yep.
But in the 20 years since Afropunk, I think the conversation has turned to, this is my experience, and I'm not even talking to you.
Yeah,
you can be here, you know, but if you know, like, I you know, you can be here. I want you here, but like, this isn't for you, you know. And so, like, when I go to a Zulu show and I see the T-shirts that say like, what does it say? Something like "End White Hardcore" or something like that. You know, it's just kind of like, yeah, thank you. You know, like, you don't think it's, or, you know, or like in between songs are playing like these kind of like current R&B songs. And like, I don't know. There's just like a very kind of like Soul Glow has, like, they just remind me of my cousins. Just like, you know, this is just like, elements of their show feel like being at a cookout or something. And it's like, you got to come and meet me where I am. And I don't know that Afropunk, like, they saw Afropunk and were like, ding, ding, ding. But I think that, you know, there was a couple of punk generations that happened in 20 years. And like, the young Black punks of today are more like, more excited about telling our stories to other punks of color, you know. I see the same thing with queer bands and girl-fronted bands. It's just like,
absolutely,
everybody's invited, but like, you're coming to my experience, you know.
I was going to say exactly that. I've got a friend who was on the show. She was in a band called Dream Nails. She's no longer in that band, but she started a new band fairly recently. But Dream Nails used to do this part in the show where they'd say "girls to the front," and they would kind of forcibly, not physically, but, you know, just over the mic, would be like, "Guys, this is your time to get the fuck out of the mosh pit now and go stand at the back of the room whilst all the women come down to the front, unthreatened by any sort of male energy, and just let loose and express themselves. Girls to the front, girls to the front." And being in the room as a man in those moments, I found completely invigorating and inspiring. And I felt uncomfortable. I felt uncomfortable as fuck, but I lived for it and I loved it. Because as you say, it's like, you're allowed to be here. I ain't telling you to leave, but what I'm not doing anymore is pandering to your experience, because this is ours. Watch it and learn, by all means.
And let, you know, and the thing that, you know, using that example is like, you know, 25 years ago, Kathleen Hanna was crucified for that, for those exact same words, you know? Yeah. So it's like, you know, I remember a band from the 90s called Teen Dresh, one of my favorite bands. And right, nice. They, yeah, they're all lesbians. Their band, their album Personal Best is like amazing, still to this day, top tier. And they used to do shows that were it was like $3 for girls, $7 for boys. They would have like early they would have women's self-defense classes. If you come an hour before the show, and they would like teach for women's self-defense, you know. And like, men were freaking out. Not men, mm-hmm. Boys, like teenage boys were freaking out, you know? And I remember, like, I was 17 and I was like, this is amazing, you know? Like, I'm listening to these lyrics about like lesbian love stories, and like, clearly this is not for me, you know? Like, they're not writing these songs for me in my experience, you know? But I'm not threatened by that, you know? Like, I can enjoy it. Or like going to Los Crudos and them singing in Spanish, it's like, yeah, this band rules. It doesn't, like, it's, but it's not for me. Like, clearly they're not even singing in my language, you know? So people just have to kind of especially white guys, like just have to realize that the whole world isn't about them. And that's something that takes, you know, that's generational work, you know, like that's work that we have will, you know, a lot of white guys are just starting to realize, you know, and I think that's the power, or that's a powerful thing that happened with Afropunk. Was I knew white people would see it. I'm talking about the documentary, I knew white people would see it, but I was very, very specific. I was very, very like intentional about making this a black conversation. So what it feels like to the white viewer is like something they've never experienced, because they've never been in a room when black people are talking when white people aren't there. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I had that experience. I had that experience as a teenager. I remember, I'll never forget going to, I was like at some kind of like anarchist bookstore or something. And what I didn't realize when I went in was that there was like a women's only space happening. And I kind of like walked up to it and quickly understood what was happening. And I was just so curious. So I like sat down and just kind of hid myself and like listened in. And I was like, oh, this is what women talk about when men aren't around. And I understand the value, because there were so many points where I wanted to like interject and be like, hey, wait a minute, what about this? You know, like, and without me there, they could just keep the conversation going, you know? So, you know, for white guys where the whole world revolves around them, including hardcore, where it's just like about white guy problems, you know, getting stabbed in the back or whatever, you know, it's like, man, is it refreshing to hear a woman's perspective, or an Indian person's perspective, or queer person's, like, fuck, man, this generation of punk rock is so exciting to me because of the amount of voices, you know, the diversity of the voices.
Yeah, and the rules are gone as well. I think traditionally there was always these certain rules with kind of the stories you were allowed to tell. And as you say, the kind of types of people who could tell them. And now it's sort of like the gloves are off, isn't it? It's awesome.
Yeah. And, you know, when you, it's like, and I think about like the 90s, and I think about like every band was talking about, you know, police brutality, or, the war in Iraq or whatever, you know, and it's like most of these kids like have never had to deal with the police outside of maybe getting a ticket, you know, have never, it would never be in an economic situation where they would have to go enlist in the army and go to war, you know, like these aren't firsthand experiences. And like, bravo for taking on those issues. I wouldn't necessarily know about some of this stuff, some of these politics, if it wasn't for, I don't know, like, you know, Crass or whatever, right? But like, when you speak from experience, it's just like so much more powerful, you know?
Well, it's all about truth,
not
right?
Not to shout out Crass. I love Crass. So not to, I was just thinking about political bands.
No, it's all good. I've had Penny on the show. I've been down to Dial House where he still lives and soaked up the vibes down there. Very cool place, man. Very cool energy. I won't say this because I now know your feelings, but John Lennon, you know, those elements of his songwriting that was slight verging on punk, let's say. And, you know, one of his most famous phrases is just give me some truth. And like, for me, that's the core of what punk songwriting is all about. Tell me your truth.
Totally. Totally. And, you know, I mean, and that's, I think that's the difference between John Lennon, the man who he was before he died, and the pop star that he was, you know, when he started or whatever. It's like, you know, all of those dudes grew, obviously, but you know, it's like more like, yo, I'm not afraid to say anything anymore, you know. And some of that comes from power, you know. I think when you get to a certain place, you can just say what the fuck you want.
Yeah,
but,
right.
you know, I think that a lot of punks start from that place, because there's nothing to lose, really. Like, I'm already in the underground playing to, like, you know, 200 people with a 7-inch. Like, you're gonna take that from me, you know?
Yeah, and I guess conversely, when you have scaled the heights and you are the most successful artist in the world at that time, to then go and say bold, crazy, you know, out there shit is, mm-hmm. you've got everything to lose then, although you've got your position of power
except for your money.
Yeah, right. They can never take that. So, go on.
Go ahead. I was going to say, you know, John Lennon could have never made another song and he'd be totally fine.
Well, it's not this, but in this context, it is this. Whenever I think about John Lennon, my head immediately goes to Imagine, and then it immediately goes to that god awful video that the celebrities made during the pandemic, tying all our conversations together, all singing from their mansions about how we should imagine a world with no possessions. And it's like, well, it's all well and good. You've been, you know, locked down in your condo with the pool and the view of the Hollywood Hills. What about me being locked down in my one bedroom apartment with no garden or windows?
Yeah, no.
Dude, it's been really engaging and wonderful chatting to you, as I sort of knew it would be. And when Melanie sort of suggested having you on, I was like, yeah, hell yeah. And like I said, I'd seen your film a few years back whilst writing this article that I'd done, and really enjoyed it then. And I look forward to the book, man. Obviously, I know how long they take, because I've written two myself. So how far along the line are you? Is there a release date sort of set in stone yet, or a rough timeline?
Well, I should, like, you know, shout out. So I have a book called Black Punk Now that I co-edited with my friend Chris Terry. That is an anthology of Black punk writers, and it's fiction, nonfiction, comics. I mean, it goes from like sci-fi to horror to comedy, like all across the spectrum. Interviews, like I said, comics. That comes out October 31st.
Oh, nice!
And yeah, so that's like just about to drop, and you know, available wherever you buy books. And then that goes in conjunction with the Black Punk Now exhibit that I'm doing at the Punk Rock Museum.
Oh yeah.
And if for all of your listeners who will be in Las Vegas in the next 6 months, go check out the Punk Rock Museum and you can see the exhibit. That's like photos of the early Afropunk days and ephemera from that time, as well as photos from the Black and Brown punk festivals that are happening today, including Decolonize, which is based in London. The book that I was talking about earlier, which is like going to be a hybrid of prose and comics.
Do you do all the illustration yourself? Obviously, being an artist, Oh, nice, great.
Yeah. So my book, The High Desert. So that book is like that's been out for a year. It's all about my first experiences in punk, growing up in the desert as a Black kid in a town filled with Nazis. that's like straight graphic novel, 365 pages. It's like a brick, you know.
Amazing.
And it's all just I wrote and illustrated the whole thing. The book that I was talking about earlier, that kind of talks about leading up to Afropunk and stuff, that is scheduled to come out in 2025. I'm writing it now. It's a combination of prose and comics, so it kind of like has some illustrations, and then it has like, you know, flyers, and you know, it's more of it's a hybrid, you know. Yeah. So
sounds like you got your work cut out, man. Stuff. Love it.
Yeah. Yeah. Lots of stuff. I try to keep busy.
And you've got your tours coming up as well, which sounds super exciting. I think the great thing about all of these tours that they're doing is everybody's relationship to punk and ideas on punk, as we've sort of, you know, proven today. And everybody's take is slightly different and personal to them. And I think you could go on every tour that, you know, is taking place from the moment they started for as long as they go, and every single one would be different, wouldn't it?
That is the beautiful thing. And the thing I was, you know, what, you know, I want to just give a shout out to the 10 or so black and brown punk festivals that are happening these days, because, you know, they're really picking up where I left off or sold out in the you know, with those early Afropunk shows. But what's really exciting and beautiful about them is that they're all very unique in their not only in the bands that you see, but just like the vibes, the energy. Like there's some that are like very queer and kind of like electronic. There's some that are like just straight up hardcore. You know, there's some that like have like an anime element to it. You know, it's like, again, black people aren't a monolith, and when they set out to create space for themselves, like, it's going to be a reflection of their unique experience, and, you know, the programming that they do is going to be a reflection of that too, you know.
Of course.
So yeah. You know, so it's really exciting to see, like, that, you know, to experience that varied degrees of like blackness or black and brownness, you know, like through all these different lenses, you know, it becomes very clear, like, oh yeah, like there are people who would love this festival and not like this one, you know, mm-hmm. Even though they're coming with the same top line objective of like promoting like black and brown punk rock, right? Not, you know, like clearly we know this of white punk rock, that not all of these bands sound the same. It's so incredibly diverse that you can have like, you know, the hardest hard song and the slowest, sappiest whatever song, and they're all under this umbrella we call punk rock, you know. So, you know, I just look forward to seeing what all of these kids do next and just continue to support, you know.
Yeah, man, congrats on everything. Like, we didn't even get into loads of the stuff I wanted to, but there's always room for a part two. And yeah, just super excited for all you've got coming up, and thanks again for a, you know, really insightful and awesome chat, my friend. I enjoyed it.
Right on. Yeah, me too. Take care.
We'll hopefully see you down the road, man. And if I'm ever in LA, I'll look you up. That's home for you, isn't it? You're LA based these days.
Yeah, yeah.
Love and life on the sunshine. Oh yeah, there you are. Let's see if my Wi-Fi can handle this. It'd be an immediate shutdown. Bosh.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. Respect. Really lovely meeting you. And good luck with the guides. Have you done anything like that before? Is it going to be your first foray into tour guide activity?
I'm not really guiding much. I made the exhibit, but
right.
Yeah. So that's just a different job or whatever.
Yeah. Well, you're curating the space and giving it.
Yeah, exactly.
Giving it the visual presentation.
Just on the day that the opening, and then our party, I'll be there to kind of like talk about it or whatever, but
right on.
That's not my thing.
That's not your MO. We all know our skills, right? We know our skills. It's best sometimes to stick to them, dude. Yeah. Congrats, big up, and have a great day, man. Take care, and talk soon. Thank you, James.
All right.
Yeah, cheers, brother. Bye now. Take care. Yeah!
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.